pace after slow, steady pace, they moved forward. Time and again, their way was blocked by sullen groups of tall, dark gallas, who stood shoulder to shoulder, fingering their weapons. Then Jake twisted the muzzle of the pistol into the Russ's soft skin. The man cried out, and reluctantly the way opened, the dark warriors moving aside just sufficiently to let them pass, and then falling in behind them, and following closely, so closely the leaders were always within an arm's length. Once they were clear of the pack, Jake could increase the pace as he moved steadily up the path, through the camel thorn, shepherding the terrified Italians ahead of him and dragging Ras Kulab bodily ahead.
"What are we going to do with them?"
Vicky asked, breathlessly.
"We can't keep Kulab at gunpoint much longer."
Jake didn't answer. He didn't want the closely following Gallus to hear the uncertainty in his voice, yet he didn't want the girl to show signs of fear. She was right, of course. The Gallus followed them now with an implacable malevolence, pressing closely in an avenging throng that filled the darkness.
"The cars," said Jake.
An inspiration came to him.
"Get into one of the cars. And then?"
"One thing at a time," growled Jake. "Let's get him into the cars first."
And they moved steadily up the path, the gallus pressing them more closely. One of the tall, cloaked figures jostled Jake roughly, trying him, beginning to push harder, and Jake moved smoothly, swinging his weight across and swiveling a quarter of a turn. It was so swift that the gallus could not avoid the blow, even if he'd seen it. He was hemmed in and constrained by the press of his comrades' bodies. Jake hit him with a forearm chop, and the barrel of the pistol caught him in the mouth, snapping off his front teeth cleanly from the upper gum. And the shock of the blow was transferred directly through the frontal sinuses to the brain. The man dropped without a sound and was immediately hidden from view by the men who stumbled over him as they followed. But they didn't press so hard now. And Jake switched the pistol back to the Ras Kulab's head. The entire incident was over before Kulab could cry out or squirm in the punishing grip that had bruised and twisted his upper arm. Jake shifted his grip again, forcing the man farther off balance, and hustled him on more urgently. Ahead of them, through the trees, he could make out the ugly humped shapes of the cars, silver-grey in the moonlight, and silhouetted by the dying ash heaps of the campfires.
"Vicky, we'll use Miss Wobbly."
"I'm not taking a chance on Priscilla starting first kick," he grated. "Use the driver's hatch. Don't worry about anything else but getting behind that wheel."
"What about the prisoners?"
"Do what you're told. Don't argue, damn it."
They were within 20 feet of the car now, and he told her,
"Now, go, fast as you can."
She darted away, reaching the high side of Miss Wobbly before any of the gallas could intervene, and she went up it with a single, agile bound.
"Close down,"
Jake shouted after her, and felt a quick lift of relief as the hatch clanged shut. The gallus growled like a wolf pack denied its prey, and they swarmed forward, pressing hard and surrounding the car. Jake fired a single shot in the air, and Ras Kulab screamed a command. The gallus drew back, fractionally, and fell into a sullen silence.
"Vicky, can you hear me?"
Jake called, as she shepherded the Italian prisoners close in against the hull. Her voice was muffled and remote from behind the steel plate as she acknowledged.
"The rear doors," he told her urgently. "Get them open. But not before I tell you."
He pushed the Italians around towards the rear of the car, but it was slow work, for they were confused and stupid with terror.
"Now!"
Jake shouted, and knocked impatiently against the hull with a pistol. The lock grated, and the doors swung outwards, and came up against the packed bodies outside.
"God damn it!"
growled Jake, and got his shoulder to one leaf of the door. He shoved it open, knocking down two of the closest gallas, and in the same moment boosted one of the Italians through the opening into the dark interior of the car. It was a panicky scramble. The other two followed him, and Jake swung the door closed on them and put his back flat against it and heard the bolts shot. Closed on the other side, facing the hating dark faces and the surging press of their hundreds of bodies. Voices were raised at the rear of the crowd and violence was seconds away. They'd seen most of their prey escape, and it needed little more to trigger the mob reflex. Jake found he was panting, as though he'd run a long way, and his heart pounded, so that he could feel it jump against his ribcage. But he held Rascular, changing his grip from the pudgy upper arm to the thick, wiry bush of his hair, twining his fingers deeply into the stiff, dark halo at the back of his skull and twisting his head so that Rascular faced his men. With the other hand, Jake thrust the pistol deeply into the aperture of the man's ear hole.
"Speak to them, sweet lips."
He made his voice vicious and menacing.
"Otherwise I'm going to push this piece right out through the other ear."
Rascular understood the tone, if not the words, and he gabbled out a few hysterical words of Amaric. The front warriors drew back a pace, and Jake slid slowly along the hull, keeping his back to the steel, and Rascular pinned helplessly by his hair to cover his front. The crowd moved with them, keeping station with them, their faces glowering in the moonlight, cruel and angry, balancing critically on the pinnacle of violence. A voice rang out from the darkness, an authoritative voice urging action. The crowd growled, and Rascular whimpered in Jake's grip. The sound of Rascular's terror warned Jake that they'd be frustrated no longer. The moment was upon them.
"Vicky, are you ready to start?"
he called urgently, and her voice was just audible.
"Ready to start."
He felt the fixed crank handle catch him in the back of the legs, and at that instant a woman's voice shrilled and echoed through the grove of camel thorn trees. In that heart-stopping ululation of the blood trill, the invocation to violence that the heart of the African warrior cannot resist, the sound struck the jostling press of Gallus like a whip-stroke, and their bodies convulsed and their voices rose in an answering blood roar.
"Oh, Jesus, here they come,"
thought Jake, and put all his strength into the arm and shoulder that took Rascular between the shoulder blades and hurled him forward into the front rank of his own men. He crashed into them, bringing down half a dozen of them in a sprawling tangle over which the next rank tumbled and fell. Jake turned swiftly and stooped to the crank handle. He'd chosen Miss Wobbly for this moment, knowing that she was the most gentle and well-intentioned of all the cars. He would have trembled to put the same trust in Priscilla, and as it was, even she coughed and hesitated at the first swing.
"Please, my darling, please,"
Jake pleaded desperately. And at the next swing of the handle, she hacked, choked, and fired. Then suddenly she was running sweetly. Jake jumped from the sponson, just as a great two-handed sword swung down at him from on high. He heard the hiss of the blade, passing like the flight of a bat in the darkness, and he ducked under it. The sword struck the steel hull of the car and sprayed a fiery burst of sparks, and Jake rolled and fired the Beretta as the Gala raised his sword to swing again. He heard the bullet slog into flesh, a meaty thump, and the man collapsed backwards, the sword spinning from his hand as he went down. But from every direction, robed figures were swarming up the hull of the car, like safari ants over the carcass of a helpless scarab beetle. And the roar of voices was a storm surf of anger.
"Drive, Vicky! For God's sake, drive!"
he yelled, and slammed the pistol over the woolly head of a Gala as it rose beside him. The man fell away, and the engine bellowed. The car bounded forward with a jerk that threw most of the Galas from the hull, and Jake was himself thrown half clear, snatching at one of the welded brackets as he went over and saving himself from falling into the swarming pack of Galas. But the pistol dropped out of his hand as he clung grimly to his precarious hold. Miss Wobbly, under Vicky's thrusting foot, roared into the thick wall of men ahead of her, and few of them had a chance to avoid her charge. The bodies went down before her, thudding against the frontal plate of the car, their blood roar changing swiftly to yells and shrieks of consternation as they scattered away into the darkness and the car burst free of the press and tore on down the slope. Jake, dragged himself back on board and steadied himself against the turret as he rose to his knees. Beside him, a Gala clung like a tick to the back of an ox, wailing in terror while his shammer swirled over his head in a stream of racing air. Jake put one foot against the man's raised buttocks and thrust hard. The man shot headfirst over the side of the speeding car and hit the earth with a crunch that was audible even above the roaring engine. Jake crawled back along the heaving, violently rocking hull, and with fist and foot, he threw overside one at a time her deck cargo of terrified Gallus. Vicky took the car down the slope under full throttle, weaving wildly through the trees of the grove and at last out onto the open, moonlit plain. Here, at last, by pounding his fist on the driver's hatch, Jake managed to arrest Vicky's wild drive, and she braked the car to a cautious halt. She came out through the hatch and embraced him with both arms, wound tightly around his neck. Jake made no attempt to avoid the circle of her arms, and a silence settled over them, disturbed only by their breathing. They'd both almost forgotten about their prisoners and the pleasure of the moment, but were reminded by the scuffling and muttering in the depths of the car. Slowly they drew apart, and Vicky's eyes were soft and lustrous in the moonlight.
"The poor things," she whispered. "You saved them from that."
And words failed her as she remembered the one they'd been too late to save. "Yes," Jake agreed. "But what the hell do we do with them now?"
"We could take them up to the Harari camp. The Ras would treat them fairly."
"Don't bet on it." Jake shook his head. "They're all Ethiopians, and their rules of the game are different from ours. I wouldn't like to take a chance on it."
"Oh, Jake, I'm sure he wouldn't allow them to..."
"Anyway," Jake interrupted, "if we handed them over to the Harari, Ras Goulard'd be there the next minute demanding them back for his fun, and if they didn't agree, we'd all be in the middle of a tribal war. No, it won't do."
"We'll have to turn them loose," said Vicky at last.
"They'd never make it back to the Wells of Chaldee." Jake looked to the east, across the brooding midnight plain. "The ground out there is crawling with Ethiopian scouts. They'd have their throats slit before they'd gone a mile."
"We'll have to take them," said Vicky.
And Jake looked sharply at her.
"Take them? In the car. Drive out to the Wells of Chaldee."
"The eye ties would love that," he grunted. "Have you forgotten those flaming great cannons of theirs?"
"Under a flag of truce," said Vicky. "There's no other way, Jake. Truly there isn't."
Jake thought about it silently for a full minute, and then he sighed wearily. "It's a long drive. Let's get going." They drove without headlights, not wanting to attract the attention of the Ethiopian scouts or the Italians, but the moon was bright enough to light their way and define the ravines and rougher ground with crisp black shadows, although occasionally the wheels would crash painfully into one of the deep round holes dug by the Avadiks. The nocturnal long-nosed beasts which burrowed for the subterranean colonies of termites. The three half-naked Italian survivors huddled down in the rear compartment of the car, so exhausted by fear and the day's adventures that they passed swiftly into sleep, a sleep so deep that neither the noisy roar of the engine within the metal hull nor the bouncing over rough ground could disturb them. They lay like dead men in an untidy heap. Vicky Campbell climbed out of the turret to escape the flow of cool night air, and squeezed into the space beside the driver's seat. For a while she spoke quietly with Jake, but soon her voice became drowsy and finally dried up. Then slowly she toppled sideways against him, and he smiled tenderly and eased her golden head down onto his shoulder and held her like that, warm against him in the noisy hull as he drove on into the eastern night. The Italian sentries were sweeping the perimeter of their camp at regular intervals with a pair of powerful anti-aircraft searchlights, probably in anticipation of a night attack by the Ethiopians, and the glow of the beams burned up in a tall white cone of light into the desert air. Jake homed in upon it, gradually reducing his throttle setting as he closed in. He knew that the engine beat would carry many miles in the stillness, but that at lower revs it would be diffused and impossible to pinpoint. He guessed he was within 2 or 3 miles of the Italian camp when in confirmation that the sentries had heard his approach, and that after their recent experiences, they were highly sensitive to the sound of a Bentley engine, a star shell sailed upwards 1,000 feet into the sky and burst with a fierce blue-white light that lit the desert like a stage for miles beneath it. Jake hit the brakes hard and waited for the shell to sink slowly to earth. He didn't want movement to attract attention. The light died away and left the night blacker than before, but beside him, the abrupt change of motion had woken Vicky, and she sat up groggily, pushing the hair out of her eyes and muttering sleepily, "What is it?" "We're here," he said. And another star shell rose in a high arc and burst in brilliance that paled the moon. "There," Jake pointed out the ridge above the wells of Chaldee. The dark shapes of the Italian vehicles were lagered in orderly lines, clearly silhouetted by the star shell. They were 2 miles ahead. Suddenly, there was the distant ripping sound of a machine gun, a sentry firing at shadows, and immediately after, a scattered fusillade of rifle shots, which petered out into a sheepish silence. "Seems that everybody's awake and jumpy as hell," Jake remarked dryly. "This is about as close as we can go." He crawled out of the driver's seat and went back to where the prisoners were still piled upon each other like a litter of sleeping puppies. One of them was snoring like an asthmatic lion, and Jake had to put his boot amongst them to stir them back to consciousness. They came awake slowly and resentfully, and Jake swung open the rear doors and pushed them out into the darkness. They stood dejectedly, clasping their naked trunks in the chill of the night and peering about them fearfully to discover what new unpleasantness awaited them. At that instant, another star shell burst almost overhead, and they exclaimed and blinked owlishly, without immediate comprehension, as Jake made shooing gestures, trying to drive them like a flock of chickens towards the ridge. Finally, Jake grabbed one of them by the scruff of the neck, pointed his face at the ridge, and gave him a shove that sent him tottering the first few paces. Suddenly the man recognized his own camp and the lines of big Fiat trucks in the light of the star shell. He let out a heartfelt cry of relief and broke into a shambling run. The other two stared for a moment in disbelief and then set out after him at the top of their speed. When they got 20 yards, one of them turned back and came to Jake, seized his hand and pumped it vigorously, a huge smile splitting his face. Then he turned to Vicky and covered both her hands with wet, noisy kisses. The man was weeping, tears streaming down his cheeks.
"That's enough of that," growled Jake. "On your way, friend."
And he turned the Italian and once more pointed him at the horizon and helped him on his way. The unaffected joy of the released Italians was contagious. Jake and Vicky drove back in high good mood, laughing together secretly in the dark and noisy hull of the car. They'd covered half of the 40 miles back to the Sardi Gorge, and behind them, the lights of the Italian camp were a mere suggestion of lesser darkness, low on the eastern horizon. But still their mood was light and joyous, and at some fresh sally of Jake's, Vicky leaned across to kiss him on the soft pulse of his throat, beneath his ear. As if of her own accord, Miss Wobbly's speed bled away and she rocked to a gentle standstill in the centre of a wide-open area of soft sandy soil and low dark scrub. Jake earthed the magneto, and the engine note died away into silence. He turned in the seat and took Vicky fully in his arms, crushing her to him with sudden strength that made her gasp aloud. "Jake!" she protested, half in pain, but his lips covered hers, and her protests were forgotten at the taste of his mouth. His jaw and cheeks were rough with new beard, the same strong, wiry growth of dark hair which curled out of his shirt front, and the man's smell of him was like the taste of his mouth. She felt the softness of her own body crave the hardness of his, and she pressed herself to him, finding pleasure in the pain of contact, in the bruising pressure of his mouth against her lips. She knew she was arousing emotions that soon would be beyond either of them to control, and the knowledge made her reckless and bold. The thought occurred to her that she had it in her power to drive him demented with passion, and the idea aroused her further, and immediately she wanted to exercise that power. She heard his breathing roaring in her ears, then realized that it was not his, it was her own, and each gust of it seemed to swell her chest until it must burst. It was so cramped in the cockpit of the car, and their movements were becoming wild and unrestrained. Vicky felt restricted and itching with constraint. She'd never known this wildness before, and for a fleeting instant she remembered the skillful, gentle minuet of formal movements which had been her loving with Gareth Swales, and she compared it to this stormy meeting of passions. Then the thought was borne away on the flood, on the need to be free of confinement. Outside the car, the chill of the desert night prickled the skin of her back and flanks and thighs, and she felt the fine golden hairs come erect on her forearms. He flapped out the bedroll and spread it on the earth. Then he returned to her, and the heat of his body was a physical shock. It seemed to burn with all the pent-up fires of his soul, and she pressed herself to it with complete abandon, delighting in the contrast of his burning flesh and the cool desert breeze upon her bare skin. Now, at last, there was nothing to prevent the range of her hands, and she knew that they were cold as ghost fingers on him, delighting to hear his gasp again at their touch. She laughed then, a hoarse, throaty chuckle. "Yes," she laughed again. As he lifted her easily and dropped to his knees on the bedroll, holding her against his chest. "Yes, Jake." She let the last restraint fly. "Quickly, quickly, my darling." It was a raging, a roaring of all her senses. It was an aching, tumultuous storm that ended at last, and afterwards the vast hissing silence of the desert was so frightening that she clung to him like a child and found to her amazement that she was weeping. The tears scalded her eyes and yet were as icy as the touch of frost upon her cheeks. General de Bono's first cautious but ponderous thrust across the Mareb River into Ethiopia met with a success that left him stunned. Ras Maglotu, the Ethiopian commander of the north, offered only token resistance, then withdrew his 40,000 men southwards to the natural mountain fortress of Amber Ardam. Unopposed, de Bono drove the 70 miles to Adwa and found it deserted. Triumphantly, he erected the monument to the fallen Italian warriors, and thereby expunged the stain of defeat from the arms of Italy. The great civilizing mission had begun. The savage was being tamed and introduced to the miracles of modern man, amongst them the aerial bomb. The Royal Italian Air Force ranged from the skies above the towering Ambers, reporting all troop movements and swooping down to bomb and machine gun any concentrations. The Ethiopian forces were confused and scattered under their tribal commanders. There were half a dozen breaches in their line that a forceful commander could have exploited. Indeed, even General de Bono sensed this and made another convulsive leap forward as far as Mekelle. However, here he stopped, appalled at his own audacity, stunned by his own achievement. Ras Maglotu was skulking on Amber Ardam with his 40,000, while Ras Kassa and Ras Sayoum were struggling to move the great unwieldy masses of their two armies through the mountain passes to link up with the army of the Emperor on the shores of Lake Tana. They were disordered, vulnerable, ripe to be cut down like wheat, and General de Bono closed his eyes, covered his brow with one hand, and turned his head aside. History would never accuse him of recklessness and impetuosity. From General de Bono, commander of the Italian Expeditionary Force at Mekelle, to Benito Mussolini, Prime Minister of Italy. Having captured Adwa and Mekelle, I consider my immediate objects have been attained. Stop. It is now vitally necessary to consolidate these successes, to fortify my position against enemy counterattack, and to secure my lines of supply and communication. From Benito Mussolini, Prime Minister of Italy, Minister of War, to General de Bono, officer commanding the Italian Expeditionary Force in Africa. His Majesty wishes, and I command you, to advance without hesitation on Amber Ardam and bring the main body of the enemy to battle as soon as possible. Stop. Reply to me. From General de Bono to the Prime Minister of Italy, greetings and felicitations.
I wish to point out to your excellency that the objective Amba Ardam is tactically undesirable. The terrain favors ambush. Caught disaster by unconsidered action. Condition of roads very poor. Trust my judgment. Urge your excellency to reconsider and to take cognizance of the fact that the military situation must take precedence over all political consideration. From Benito Mussolini, the Marshal de Bono, previously officer commanding the Italian Expeditionary Force in Africa. His Majesty orders me to convey his felicitations on your elevation to the rank of Marshal of the Army and to thank you for the impeccable exhaustion of your duty in recapturing Adowa. Stop. With the attainment of this objective, I consider that your mission in Eastern Africa has been completed. Stop. You have earned the gratitude of the nation by your obvious merits as a soldier and your steadfast discharge of your duty as a commander. Stop. You are requested to hand over your command to General Pietro Badoglio on his imminent arrival in Africa. Marshal de Bono accepted both his promotion and his recall with such good grace that it could have been mistaken by an uninformed observer for profound relief. His departure for Rome was completed with such dispatch as to avoid by a hair's breadth the semblance of indecorous haste. General Pietro Badoglio was a fighting soldier. He'd staffed the headquarters before Adowa, although he'd played no part in that debacle, and he was a veteran of Caporetto and Vittorio Veneto. He believed that the purpose of war was to crush the enemy as swiftly and as ruthlessly as was possible, with the use of any weapon at his disposal. He came ashore at Massawa with a furious impatience, angry with everything he found, and impatient of the policies and concepts of his predecessor, although in truth seldom had an incoming commander been handed such an enviable strategic situation. He inherited a huge, well-equipped army, with a buoyant morale, in a commanding tactical position, and backed by a magnificent network of communications and a logistics inventory that was alpine in proportions. The small but magnificently equipped air force of the expedition was flying unopposed over the Amber Mountains, observing all troop movements and pouncing immediately on any Ethiopian concentrations. During one of the first dinners at the new headquarters, Lieutenant Vittorio Mussolini, the younger of the Duce's two sons, one of the dashing Regia Aeronautica aces, regaled his new CNC with accounts of his sorties over the enemy highlands. And Badoglio, who had not had close aerial support in any of his previous campaigns, was delighted with this new and deadly weapon. He listened, transfixed, to the young flyer's descriptions of the effect of aerial bombardment, particularly an account of an attack on a group of 300 or more enemy horsemen, led by a tall, dark-robed figure. The young Mussolini told him, "I released a single 100-kilo bomb from an altitude of less than 100 meters, and it fell precisely in the center of the galloping horsemen. They opened like the petals of a flowering rose, and the dark-robed leader was thrown so high by the blast that he seemed to almost touch my wingtip as I passed. It was a spectacle of great beauty and magnificence." Badoglio was happy that his new command included young men with such fire in their veins, and he leaned forward in his seat at the head of the table to peer down over the glittering silver and sparkling leaded crystal at the flyer in his handsome blue uniform. The classical features and dark curly head of hair were the artist's conception of young Mars. Then he turned to the Air Force colonel who sat beside him.
"Colonel, what is the opinion of your young men in the Regia Aeronautica? I have heard much argument for and against, but I would be interested to have your opinion. Should we use the nitrogen mustard?"
"I think I speak for all my young men." The colonel sipped his wine and glanced for confirmation at the young ace, who was not yet 20 years of age. "I think the answer must be yes. We must use every weapon available to us." Badoglio nodded. The thinking agreed with his own, and the next morning he ordered the canisters of mustard gas shipped from the warehouses of Massawa, where de Bono had been content to let them lie,
and dispatched them to every airfield where flights of the Regia Aeronautica were based. Thousands upon thousands of the wild tribesmen of Ethiopia would come to know the corrosive dew when later they endured bombardment by artillery and aerial attack with a stoicism greater than most European troops were able to muster. Yet they could never come to terms with this terrible substance that turned the open pastures of their mountain fastnesses to fields of terror. Barefoot, as most of them were, they were pathetically vulnerable to the silent, insidious weapon that flayed the skin from their bodies and then stripped the living flesh from the bone. The single decision was one of many made that day by the new commander and signaled the change from De Bono's bumbling, not unkindly, civilizing invasion to the new concept of total war, war with only one objective. Mussolini had wanted a hawk, and he'd chosen well.